You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Fiona Barton is my guest. She is the author of the best-selling novels The Widow, The Child, The Suspect, and her latest, Local Gone Missing. Fiona Barton was a senior writer at the Daily Mail, news editor at the Daily Telegraph, and chief reporter at the Mail on Sunday, and was named Reporter of the Year at the National Press Awards. Fiona Barton, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Hi, thanks so much for inviting me.
It's a pleasure to have you. I read your new book, Local Gone Missing, over the Father's Day weekend, and your book is dedicated to your father, who passed away recently. And so I wonder if you might tell us a bit about your father and the role he played in your life as a writer.
Sure. Yeah. There's a plane going over. Is that annoying you?
I don't hear it.
Okay, good. It's a Spitfire, actually. But anyway, Dad would have loved that.
You're back to the Battle of London.
Absolutely. My father was a journalist for many, many years. And so I grew up, he was a district man. And so I grew up in a newsroom, really, because he worked from home. In those days, he was going out on stories and then coming back and filing them on the phone. So I'd be sitting there having my fish fingers for tea, and he would be filing, you know, the news story of the day, a murder trial or a missing person or, you know, something exciting. And I was just so thrilled to be at the center of it with him. I've got a brother and sister. It didn't bite them like it bit me. But, you know, Dad was always sitting, typing. And so I got the journalism bug from him, but also the love of books. Dad and Mum were great readers, passionate readers, at the library all the time and always sat with a book. So. Yeah, I was the eldest, and so they passed that on to me in spades, really. It's you know, something that I've always done. And you know, Dad encouraged. I mean, to be honest, he didn't want me to be a journalist.
No.
He said it wasn't for women. He was of that generation. Yeah. He thought it would make me hardened. But I ignored him, obviously. And he was thrilled, actually, when I did it. I think he wanted to test that it wasn't just, you know, following in Dad's footsteps or whatever, that it was something that I had a real yen to do. So, yeah, I've got so much from him. Goodness. Yeah, he was the making of me.
Did you go to journalism school, or did you just find a job, or how did it work for you?
Well, because Dad was slightly resistant, he said, why don't you go to university and do a subject that you can use, you know, as a fallback position. So I did French and theatre studies. Bizarre. Cool. And loved it. I've always loved French. So,
and what about theatre? Were you an actress?
Well, we did acting. It was a drama course, and that was just sheer self-indulgence, really. I was never going to use that. But no, I loved it. But I knew that I wanted to do journalism. So I applied, and I was accepted on a postgraduate training course on a local paper, little local paper, the East Grinstead Observer. In Sussex, where I am now. Yeah, come full circle. So then you were indentured. I mean, it was like Thomas Hardy. You signed these indenture documents that were really old school, and they paid you nothing, but they trained you on the job. Things have changed hugely now. I mean, you know, kids now go and do journalism degrees or whatever, and then do a postgraduate MA. I got my national certificate for proficiency in journalism or something, and NCTJ. Yes. something like that. And then I was paid properly, and I was a trained journalist, but it was very on the job, and I loved that. That was great.
I imagine that a lot of the people in journalism were of your father's generation. So did you encounter a lot of resistance because you're female and you're striving forth?
Well, I have to say no, because a lot of reporters are women. It's as you progress up is where it gets a bit sticky, because having a family and being a reporter, being an executive is quite hard to do. So, but no, I didn't. I mean, I was never passed over for a story. I was always a news reporter, hard news reporter. And nobody ever said, well, we better not send you because you're a woman.
They didn't just send you to cover flower shows and things.
No, they didn't, which was great. Because I think generation before me, definitely, it was the fluffy end. You know, it was the human interest features and, you know, that kind of thing. So, no, I really didn't. But I was blessed with fantastic news editors, all of them men. Of course, but they were fine. You know, they absolutely got it that we were all doing the same job. So that was great.
And then you became a news editor.
I know. Yeah, there weren't many, I tell you, but it was at a stage of my career where my children were pretty well grown up, so I could devote the hours, but oh my goodness. I mean, 12 hour days plus the traveling, the commuting, it was burnout territory, but I did love it. I mean, it's like running the Ringling Brothers Circus. You've got all these people covering different things and you are the point of contact and managing the whole thing.
So you would decide what the headline would be and what stories you would print.
Well, I would suggest, I knew what the stories were. And then we had big meetings where we decided what's the agenda today, what's the big story. And I'd be there selling them, telling them exactly what was in each story. So, yeah, it was good, really good. I had very good editors. So, I enjoyed it.
And at a time when newspapers were still things that people read. I don't know if people read a lot of newspapers now.
Well, they do, but it's just, you know, a different thing. I used to read every single daily paper on my train journey up to start my shift as a news editor. I had paper copies. You know, I mean, you would never see that now. You don't see people reading papers on trains anymore. It's all online, which is fine. You know, I don't have any quarrel with that. And I think people just are getting their news from different places now. Print really can't stagger on for too much longer, I don't think. It's too expensive.
Well, I guess because it's too late. I mean, by the time you get it in the morning.
Yeah, it's gone. It's gone. I mean, I do read the Times every day, but I have to read other news sites to sort of update me, because it's sort of the Times when it went to bed the night before. So, but I do, you know, I can read all the columnists and the analysis, and you still get that. But yeah, it's got to move. And I think it's coming soon, I think, the end of print.
Oh, well, I hope not. But I feel the same about books. I mean, I received your book in the mail, and Local Gone Missing, Fiona Barton. And it's a beautiful book. I mean, it's like, I want to read it because I saw this picture on the cover and draws you right in. It's not really the same as my Kindle.
I'm afraid I've stopped Kindle. I went for it big time, because I was traveling so much and it was just brilliant. I'd be, you know, in the back of beyond in the Irrawaddy Delta in Myanmar, and I could download a book instantly, you know, any book I wanted. And so it was fantastic. But it's sort of what it's exactly what you're saying. if I'm reading it on Kindle, I forget which book I'm reading. I forget what it's called, what the cover looks like. And I don't have those, you know, that information when I'm telling somebody about a book I've read. I'll struggle to say who wrote it. And that never used to be the case. Could be age, mind you.
But also you can picture the book. You can picture the book that you had in your hand.
Yeah.
You see it all the time. Yeah. Also, you never know when you're nearing the end. And there's a certain acceleration of reading when you get near the end of the book, right?
Mm. Yeah, no, absolutely. So, I've gone back to books in my hand. I do read proofs sometimes on a reader, an e-reader. But if I want to sort of get the whole experience, that's what I do go for paper now.
Well, I'm wondering about the influences in terms of you becoming a novelist. And you mentioned drama. So, I mean, I think that there's a dramatic structure to literature that is different than in journalism. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, no, there is. I mean, obviously the structure is, it's elongated for a start, but what I had to unlearn when I stopped being a reporter and started writing fiction, there will be those that say journalists do write fiction, but that isn't true. But the big unlearning for me was, as a reporter, you put the whole story in the first paragraph. I mean, you've got to tell the story straight away. So that's not so good for a thriller.
No.
So I had to learn the drip, drip, drip. And I also, I always used a lot of voices in whatever I wrote, because that's what journalists do. You talk to a lot of people. You get everybody's voice who's got something to say in there. And I couldn't quite let go of that. So the structure I gave it, my first novel, was to give different narrators a voice. And people thought, people sort of said to me, oh, goodness, that's a complicated way of doing it. But it came very naturally to me. And it meant that I then had more of a dramatic structure, because I could, you know, flip to another narrator and wrong foot the reader as well. So journalism is not drip, 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 or shouldn't be. You know, it's telling the story bish, bash, bosh.
Concisely as possible, right?
Exactly. Short, but I do still write very short sentences. I can't leave that. That's my style, I suppose. Yeah. So I hope I've taken the best of each genre, and maybe not, but
the Widow has a journalist in it right away. Is that you? Is that your cameo appearance in your first novel?
No, I'm not Kate Waters, as I always say very carefully. She's an amalgam of many journalists that I've worked with, known. I've taken bits from different people. We don't share DNA, but she's been everywhere that I have, you know, so we have a shared experience in a lot of the things that she does. But she doesn't always react as I did. I've got her reacting in different ways. So, yeah, she was interesting because she wasn't supposed to be a big character, Kate. I just needed somebody for the widow, Jean, to tell her story to. So I thought, oh, I'll put a journalist in there. Anyway, of course, you know, I loved writing the journalist. So she grew and grew, had her own chapters. And then second book, she is the investigator. You know, she's at the heart of the book. So, yeah. So like a good journalist, she stayed.
Do you feel like your characters are out of control, out of your control to a certain extent?
No. I just enjoyed writing her so much. It was like coming home. You know, it's... So it was when I started Local Gone Missing with a detective at the heart of it, that was quite a clunking of gears, really. I've had to do a lot of research.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that.
Because policing has changed a lot since I stopped being a reporter in 2008. So, yeah, it's But it's been good. It's been, you know, it's refreshing to do something slightly different and different location and all that kind of thing.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf, and we're chatting this week with Fiona Barton. She's an award-winning journalist. She's the author of the novels The Widow, The Suspect, and her latest, Local Gone Missing.
Well, I always love the acknowledgement section in an author's book, if I love the book. And your acknowledgement section, in addition to talking about your father, you mentioned, you know, all the, you kind of gave hints as to the manner in which you assembled the novel and all the people that you, I mean, it's like a lot of research. I mean, you approach writing a novel in a journalistic way, I guess.
I need to have my foot on the ground. I'm not doing science fiction or fantasy. And I just like to be able to touch reality in all the characters. I need to know, you know, that it's somebody maybe I interviewed 20 years ago. I'll think, yeah, there was that. Do you remember that woman? And so, yeah, I do definitely ground my characters in real life. I can't do it any differently. You know, letting go is tricky when you've done it for 30 years, where you've checked everything, you've checked the quotes, you've checked all the facts. To suddenly say, oh, I'm just going to make it all up is quite a thing.
But you do have to make up the story, and that's the hardest part.
Yeah.
Did you always have a lot of stories, fictional stories rattling around in your head that were saying, you know, you got to write these things?
Not really, no. I mean, I didn't think of writing a book until I stopped being a reporter. I was writing every day anyway, so I had, you know, I was scratching that itch. And I've always been, as I say, a passionate reader. So, you know, that the reading gave me so much pleasure. And I didn't have time. I had a full-time job. I had kids. I had, you know, a commute. And so it was only when I stopped, you know, stepped off that I had a bit of space in my head and in my life. And that's when I really started thinking about them. But it was the characters that came first, definitely.
Well, your stories. Okay, I have several questions that I'm going to just calm down and ask them all. All right, first of all, the title of your new book, Local Gone Missing, is a departure from The Widow, The Child, and The Suspect. Did your publishers or editors say, no, it has to be called The Local or The Missing or something?
No, quite the reverse. No, because it was a new main character, a new location, they wanted to make it a different title. Serious, to signal all that. I mean, you know, they know. I decided on The Widow when I wrote it. I had that title on the title page from the first day. I knew that was right. And then they quite liked the's. So they stuck with it, and they named the other books. Titles are pretty tricky things to get right. Yes. And they know, you know, what people pick up, what speaks to people. So I listened to them. I got
After The Girl on the Train, there were 10,000 books that started with the words The Girl.
Oh, gosh. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And you're now getting, have you had the Richard Osman books, the Thursday Murder Club?
I haven't read this.
Oh, they're great fun. Great fun. But that sort of title, that sort of cozy crime title is now having a real, you know, flourish.
Well, no, your books are not cozy, but they are crime stories. Did you think of writing, you know, a novel, a dramatic story? Or, I mean, why crime? Because you're a journalist, or why crime?
I suppose I'm fascinated by crime, but actually The Widow didn't set out to be a crime story. It was in my head when I started, it was going to be about a marriage with secrets. But I had to give the widow, I had to give her a dilemma that she couldn't just explain away, you know. So if your listeners, she's married to a man who's accused of taking a child. And that was the worst crime I could think of, that she would not be able to say, you know, he was led on, he was, you know, somebody else made him do it, you know, it was something that is unforgivable. So that's how the crime came into it. And as I say, I am fascinated by it. You know, I covered quite a lot of crime as a hard news reporter. I had characters in my head from those days, from trials, from stories, from interviews that revolved around crime. And it's just so interesting for me anyway, to discover why somebody would do something like that. What is it that changes somebody into a murderer or an abductor or, you know, or whatever? What is that moment? I got a bit sort of embedded in that. And I was told I'd written a psychological thriller. So I was off to the races, really. So I've stuck with it, really. Yeah.
So in the structure of Local Gone Missing, without any spoilers, there's a sort of a shift in time back and forth. There are like two timelines going on in the, or at least two timelines going on in the book. Yeah. So how did you come up with that idea, and how did you keep it all straight? Did you have a bulletin board or something?
Oh goodness, I should have had one, shouldn't I? I enjoy writing different timelines, and I thought it worked for this book that you were in the present. There's a first person narrator as well as two third person narrators. And so you have got a present tense going forward. But I love just giving people a glimpse of what had happened before. So you think you know the story. Oh, right. OK, so off we go. Yes. So that's that. And that's she's whatever. And then you skip back 2 weeks or a week, and you see the build up and perhaps something completely different to what you believed. So I was trying to do that. I didn't have a bulletin board. I'm a terrible cheat. I normally do my spreadsheet at the end of the book because I hate planning. But sometimes I do. So I do it at the end of the book just to check that I've got the timeline right. But it's just a lot of back and forth and writing sometimes, you know, the first timeline, correct, sometimes the present, just juggling it in my head, really.
I'm sorry, you cut out for a minute. It's a lot of back and forth.
Yeah, it is, because you're going merrily along and then you think, oh, no, that wouldn't happen. And then you've got to go back and change it again, you know, in the first timeline. So there is a lot of, you know, lots of traffic between the two time zones.
Well, you again, thinking of your acknowledgements, you talked about people who guide you as you go. So how many drafts do you do of a novel?
More than you'd think, probably. I think there's a lovely romantic notion that writers sit and triddle along and then ta-da, it's done. Unfortunately, not. But I will put in a draft, which is called the first draft, into my editors on deadline. But I will probably, I mean, I edit as I go along. I will probably have done at least two major drafts, plus doing the back and forth, the checking. So in goes the first draft, and they say, "Ooh, right, okay, we like this bit. We're not keen on that bit. You need more pace in this bit. I mean, you need fresh eyes on this." So
is it discouraging when they? I mean, do you want them to say it's perfect?
Wouldn't that be nice? No, what they say is, you know, this is perfect, but could you just do this? You know, they're lovely. They're so encouraging. And I've been edited all my working life, so I'm not precious about anything. I've had, you know, stories thrown back at me and told, you know, that this is rubbish, rewrite it. So I'm well used to it. And I've got two very talented editors, and I know they're right. I mean, the first time I thought, well, actually, I think, you know, perhaps we ought to leave it like that. But I have learned over time that they're absolutely right. And it's, I'm lucky to have them, you know, to their job, they tell me, is to make it the best it can be. So I can't argue with that, can I?
How long does a novel take? And did The Widow take longer than any other, or do they all take about the same?
Yeah, the novel, The Widow, took, goodness, I started it in 2009, wrote the first 9 chapters and the end, and then put it in a drawer until we were living in Sri Lanka at the time. And so we came back from there, went to lived in London for a year, then went to France. And it was in France that I started really getting back into it. So it was kind of cooking in my head for quite a long time. And then I joined a writing group in France, and they encouraged me. So I got to 10,000 words and thought, I've got nothing left to say. I'd never written 10,000 words in one go. So I sent it off to a competition, and they said, you're shortlisted, but you've got to finish it in 6 months. They gave me a deadline. So I had to write the other 70,000 words in 6 months. So, but it was exactly what I needed, a deadline. And I did it. I did it. And I was runner up, and I thought, well, I've got a finished book here. So yeah, it took a while, but once I had the finished book, I got an agent and I got a publisher very quickly, actually. It was yes, I was very lucky, very lucky. But the others take about 18 months.
So once you kind of broke ground and knew what you were doing, you could do it again?
Not so much, really. It's terrible. You think, oh, right, okay, well, I've written a book, I can do it. So it does give you that confidence. But each book is like a mountain to climb. And the second book was a nightmare. I was so panicked by the idea of handing it in. You know, I had a deadline from the get-go. And so I raced to finish it. And it was just, you know, gobbledygook. And they were so nice. The publishers said, there was a bit of a silence. And then they said, would you like a bit more time? Very sweet. So I said, yes, please. And I rewrote the second 40,000 words. Uh-huh. I changed so much. And what I learned was writing is not just putting your fingers on the keypad. There's a lot of thinking that can go on, and that's writing as well. So I learned. But yeah, it's about 18 months each time.
And is it kind of, to what degree do you work backwards? In other words, you know, you obviously must know how it's all going to resolve before you don't know how it's going to end.
Not always. The Widow, I think, because I wrote the end, the beginning. Yeah. But The Child, the second one, no, I rewrote it completely. Third one, The Suspect, I thought I knew the ending, but it's quite a complex ending. Yeah, quite chewy. So I did go back and forth on that. I don't want to give anything away, but yeah. You know, I did, but I wasn't sure. And Local Gone Missing, no, I really didn't know for sure what had happened. It sort of developed. It unfolded before me. Thank goodness.
So you're not always in control of what's happening in the story.
No.
That's interesting.
No. I'm not a planner. I'm more of a plunger. and I start with the characters because that's what interests me. I love a good, you know, I love exploring, you know, people's motivations and all the rest of it. So I'll start with them and do a bit of, you know, what if this was to happen or that was to happen? And I might take a theme. The book that I'm writing now, the second one in the Ebbing, has got at its heart the online dating thing. So I will take, you know, themes that I'm interested in, social media or poor Elise King, you know, women dealing with the aftermath of cancer, how they feel they're seen. Are they seen as victims? Are they, you know, are they seen as not up to the job anymore? And I was very interested to explore that.
What inspired that interest?
Friends who have had breast cancer, I think. And I wanted a detective who was conflicted, you know, had things to deal with. But I didn't want it, you know, I didn't want it to always be, you know, alcohol or drugs or, you know. I wanted something that she has not caused herself. You know, it isn't that she's, you know, she's done nothing wrong. It's happened to her. And she's a woman who thought she knew exactly where she was going. You know, she had it all planned. And then the whole thing implodes, you know, the love of her life, that ends in a rather brutal way. And she's diagnosed with breast cancer. And so it kind of challenges everything she thought she knew about herself. So
did you do research by inquiring with your friends about what kind
absolutely.
Of physical things?
And I found two fantastic women detectives who had breast cancer and started a charity. And they talked very openly, very frankly about what they'd gone through and what they felt like going back to work, which was so useful for me.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we are chatting this week with award-winning journalist and best-selling novelist Fiona Barton. Her new book is called Local Gone Missing.
You were a very successful journalist, and then you left journalism and went to Sri Lanka. What
were you thinking?
Yes, that's my question. That's my question.
Pretty much what my dad said. Well, it was because my husband and I had talked about volunteering when we retired. We'd talked about doing VSO, voluntary service overseas. We'd heard about it. We were very interested in it. And we got to our 50s and thought, why are we waiting? You know, why wait to retire? And I was at a stage where I wanted to do something different. And so we applied. We'd no idea if we'd get accepted. It's quite a thing to be accepted. They take professionals, mature professionals, who then go and mentor in the health service, in business. And for me, it was journalists in Sri Lanka. Anyway, they took us and sent me to work with Tamil journalists, which was a bit risky. At the time, there was a civil war on, and Tamil journalists were being murdered, and not just Tamil journalists, were being murdered and kidnapped and tortured. It was just, you know, it was a no-brainer when they said yes and we'd like you to do this. I thought, well, you know, why am I sticking around here? You know, the whole journalism was changing anyway. The online was really booming, and you know, it was, there was a day, and it was the American elections, presidential elections, and it was Hillary Clinton and Obama. And it was so exciting. The first woman, the first black man could be president. And there was a thing on the, you know, one of these things on the newspaper web page saying most popular, most read story. And it was the most read story that day was what has Billy Zane got in his swimming trunks? And I thought, okay.
Good time to leave journalism.
Maybe now's the moment. Anyway, so off we went. Half of our friends thought we were crazy. Half said, gosh, you know, we'd like to do that too. So it was a step into step off the cliff, but it was really worthwhile. You know, it changed everything, which was great.
How long were you in Sri Lanka?
Just coming up 2 years, and then I continued training journalists abroad. I met people from a Swedish university who were sending trainers out to different countries. So I worked for them and worked with African and Asian and Central European journalists, and then spent 6 months in Myanmar helping to set up a college of journalism there.
So did you keep your home? And I mean, did you take all your stuff with you? How did it go?
No. We kept our home. We knew we were going for 2 years, so we rented it out, put everything in the loft. And because at the time our kids were old enough to be left, you know, they were at uni or, you know, or beyond actually. Our parents were, you know, young enough that they didn't need us to look after them. So it was the perfect moment to go. And it gave me a second career, which was adult learning. It was training journalists, and a third career, because I was in Myanmar when I finished The Widow. That was my 6 months to finish it, and that coincided with me, you know, working in Myanmar. So that was it was a great opportunity,
and a great thing that you did. Thank you for doing it.
Well, thank no, I mean, you know, I'm absolutely in awe of the young people who still want to be journalists in countries where, you know, people are killed with impunity.
Well, all over the world, of course, news yes, is a news. I mean, the existence of facts and truth is in danger everywhere, right?
It is. And it absolutely brings it home to you when you go to a country like Sri Lanka or Myanmar, where people will risk, you know, their well-being, their lives in some cases, to bring the truth to people. It makes you realise what journalism is for, and why we should not take it for granted in the West. Write it's, about what's in Billy Zane's swimming trunks.
I think we all know what's in there.
I think we do. Let's not go there.
in 2016, when Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were facing off in the presidential election, every day in the newspaper, in the New York Times, it said that Hillary Clinton was far ahead and that Donald Trump had no chance of becoming president of the United States. Mm-hmm. And that summer, I went to England. And wherever I was in England, I saw these leave posters about Brexit in favor of leaving. But everybody that I talked to said, mm-hmm. Oh, no, we'll never leave. We're not going to leave. It's absolutely not going to happen. We're never going to leave. And then. Yeah. And then they left.
And then.
In fact, the day that we left England, was the day they had their vote. And when we arrived back in the United States, we found that they had, in fact, voted to leave. And that gave us pause because,
impossible can happen.
Right. And then it did over here as well.
I was sitting in an airport when the results came in for Donald Trump. I was in Sweden. And, you know, the airport went absolutely silent. Apart from, you know, we were all watching the screen thinking, this can't be happening. But as you say, we'd been through Brexit, and I went to bed that night. We were in France at the time. We were living in France. I went to bed thinking, OK, it's going to be all right. Horrible, horrible campaign, and divisive and nasty. And my friend rang me at, I don't know, 4 a.m. or something. She said, we've left. We've left. I've just seen the result. I just couldn't believe it. And, you know, I mean, it's what we're going to do. I don't know. But I think it was because in the on the Trump thing was that nobody took him seriously. People treated him like a joke. And but the people who voted for him didn't. And
it was so in that way, it was like Brexit.
On our part, thinking, oh, of course he won't get in.
Very much like Brexit.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, so Boris didn't think we'd be leaving.
And Trump didn't think
he'd believe it. Anyone could not believe it.
So what role do you think journalism has played? I mean, it's kind of been a failure of journalism, in other words, because in both cases, journalists and papers of record thought the opposite was true.
I think part of the problem was that the papers of record took a stance, and so they didn't discuss all the issues, and those were being discussed on social media. And so there was a whole alternative media going on. You know, the papers were all, you know, writing great big opinion pieces, and but they just, yeah, they failed to address it properly. They didn't give both sides, and so that became a stick to, you know, beat the media with afterwards, that it felt biased, their coverage, that it was sort of, you know, the metro-centric newspapers based in the big cities thought this was what the people wanted to hear, but in fact the people didn't, you know, they were discussing it elsewhere and not listening, and getting more and more furious, I think, about the coverage and the bias in it. So, yeah, it was a terrible time.
Do you think?
And it was happening across, I mean, it wasn't just, that was what was interesting. It wasn't just America and England. It was across Europe as well.
Across the world, yeah. Do you think there's been any correction in journalism since 2016?
Not so much really, no. That's why I think you know, print will have to disappear before it can properly write itself. I think we've come back from the everybody's a journalist nonsense at the beginning of social media. We have. But, you know, the fake news thing, that's not gone away.
No.
It's scary.
Yes. Is it the same in England that people live in their bubble and they believe what they believe no matter what?
Yeah. Yeah. And the algorithms all, you know, play to that. So you never see, if you, you know, if you're on social media, you don't see any competing opinions. You see a lot of abuse hurled at you if you say something that somebody disagrees with. But there's no kind of reasoned, you know, there's no sort of conversation. It's just, you're wrong, you know, I'm going to murder you. And oh dear.
Trying times. And it's a lovely time to vanish into a novel. I have one that I recommend. It's called Local, Gone Missing, Small Town, Big Secrets, by Fiona Barton, the New York Times bestselling author of The Widow. Fiona Barton, thank you so much for spending some time with us. Congratulations on this book.
Thank you so much. It's been really interesting. Thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.